Joining me in the studio with today's headlines is Sarah Martin. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Annie. First, a wrap of COVID-19 statistics. Globally, we have over 10.4 million cases and over 500,000 deaths. The United States has the highest number of cases with over 2.6 million, and they're followed by Brazil with 1.4 million. The curve for both of those countries just keeps on going upwards. Russia follows with just under 650,000 cases, but daily reported cases there are dropping, so they appear to be getting on top of it, as do other hotspots, the United Kingdom and Peru. In Australia, in the past 24 hours, Victoria has reported 73 new cases, and Premier Daniel Andrews has locked down key suburbs through Melbourne in response and has warned that he will not shy away of putting the whole state back in lockdown if that's what's needed. The New South Wales government has moved to ban people living in Melbourne's coronavirus hotspots from entering the state and could impose a fine of $11,000 or 6 months jail for anyone who's caught. And those penalties also apply to anyone from New South Wales whose visits affected Melbourne suburbs. New South Wales has also reported 14 new cases, all of whom are returned travellers and are in hotel quarantine. Meanwhile, in good news, Queenslanders can do a whole lot more from this Friday, including gatherings of up to 100 people, opening of nightclubs, massage parlours, casinos, gaming rooms, saunas and food courts.
It's a mixed picture, isn't it? We'll be talking a little later in the program to a public health expert about that. Despite a promise in 1997 of 50 years of a high degree of autonomy, the people of Hong Kong woke up this morning to a controversial national security law imposed by China.
Yes, the anti-sedition law gives the Chinese government sweeping powers over the semi-autonomous territory, targeting crimes of secession, subversion, terrorism and collusion with foreign forces. The law comes with serious penalties, including between 10 years to life in prison for suspects, charges, leaders or core members of groups that commit crimes. And it also allows for trial without jury in cases requiring protection of national secrets or foreign factors, as well as barring of the press from proceedings involving state secrets or risk to public order, which mainland China expands to cases involving political dissidents. There's also scope for Hong Kong police to use covert surveillance, intercept communications and take other invasive measures to investigate national security crimes. The move has been very quickly criticised by the USA, Japan and the EU and Taiwan, which Beijing claims as its own territory to be brought under its control by force if necessary. So I imagine they're quite worried about these moves. And leaders of the pro-democracy group Demasito, Joshua Wong, Nathan Law and Agnes Chow, have been prominent in all of the protest action. They've announced that they're stepping down due to fears that they will be prime targets of the new security measures.
Fairly accurate, I would imagine. Amid a politically unsettled world, Australia's also announced a big cash injection for defence.
That's right. In preparation for a post-COVID world that he says is poorer, more dangerous and more disorderly, Prime Minister Scott Morrison today announced $270 billion in defence spending over the next 10 years. The Defence Force will use the spending to purchase long-range weapons that could strike ships or land from thousands of kilometres away, and that's a first for the country. It will also boost cyber capacity and surveillance and build a network of satellites so Australia has an independent communications network. He says strategic competition between China and the USA, as well as other regional tensions, indicate an unsettled geopolitical situation and that we need to be able to respond with credible military force if required. Paul Barrett AO is former Secretary of Defence and President of Australians for War Power Reform. I spoke to him about it and he says it's good news that the government's focusing on our own region.
Given that it's saying that this is where a lot of instability will occur and the epicentre of a lot of the turbulence in world events ahead, then investing in our own defence and shaping our defence force specifically for the defence of Australia and its territories is what we should always be about. And most governments say that's what they're about, but we keep wandering off onto little military adventures in the Middle East.
Do you think it also signifies that we don't feel that we can rely on the US to help us out as much as perhaps we could have historically?
What I read in the statement's ambiguous about that. It's buying very sophisticated, high-technology US weapons. That suggests to me that the acquisition has been in the pipeline for a very long time. because the US has very strict controls over exports of these weapons. Now, the problem raised by Brian Toohey, defence writer, a few months ago was that most of our equipment is so tightly locked into the US command and control structure that he raises doubts that we can actually operate this on our own. So on the one hand, there are vibes that we're less sure about the US as an ally, but on the other hand, we continue to be technologically really tightly linked into the US, and I wonder just how much meaningful independence we have.
And in terms of the local geopolitical balance, we're seeing a cooling of relationship with China at the moment, but I would expect that decisions on such a policy announcement and such a big spend have been made over a much longer time. Do you think it's a response?
I think the government's handling of the relationship with China has been very clumsy, and we've got ourselves into the extraordinary position where ministers can't pick up the phone and talk to their Chinese counterpart. Something else that's extraordinary is, more or less explicitly, although the Prime Minister himself hasn't done it, Peter Jennings has done it on his behalf, speaking for the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, designating China as the enemy. What one normally does is prepare for whatever eventualities might arise as best you can, but you don't spell out which countries you're concerned about. You just make sure you've got the capacity to deal with the contingencies that you think might lie ahead. The other thing I see in this, we invest vastly more in defence than we do in diplomacy. We have one of the smallest diplomatic services of our size for any OECD country or for a country big enough to be a member of the G20. And the first line of the nation's defence is really to have very effective diplomacy that enables you to know what your neighbours are thinking, enables you to foresee problems, and enables you to head off problems. We keep resorting to military responses, and we should put an equivalent effort into making sure that military responses aren't required.